A life sentence for the butcher of Bosnia today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A war crimes tribunal finds former Serbian commander Ratko Mladic guilty of genocide during the Bosnian War. This former Bosnian refugee says anyone guilty of war crimes today should take notice.
I hope that those who are committing crimes in Myanmar or those who have committed crimes in Syria can be reminded of the fact that justice is slow but it's sure.
Plus, what the verdict means for Bosnia's post-war generation, and later using virtual reality to bring people face-to-face with their enemies.
I turn around and see the two combatants walk into the room.
Oh.
I can tell they're not real, but it's unsettling.
That's all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We start with the verdict handed down today to Ratko Mladic, one of the most notorious military commanders of the Bosnian War in the 1990s. 5 years after his trial began, Mladic was sentenced to life in prison for genocide and war crimes. This is a man who is known as the Butcher of Bosnia.
Mladic is the epitome of evil.
That's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad Al Hussein. The UN tribunal in The Hague convicted Mladic on 10 of 11 charges. In Srebrenica in particular, the court found that Mladic significantly contributed to the genocide there in 1995. More than 7,000 Bosniak men and boys were murdered. It was the worst atrocity in Europe since World War II. Among the victims, nearly every male relative of this woman, Mirsada Mladic. She was one of hundreds of witnesses who testified against Ratko Mladic.
I lost my husband, my two sons, my two brothers-in-law, a father-in-law, a nephew, uncles and their sons. You cannot even count them all. We all lost everything.
We're going to hear now from Arminka Helic. She was born in the former Yugoslavia, and she was forced to flee the fighting as a refugee. Now she's a member of the British House of Lords. Helic has also advised the UK government on what justice should look like for the victims of the Bosnian War.
I have been one of the lucky ones who has emerged unscathed in terms of not losing immediate members of my family in the war. But the verdict will mean a lot to the families of the victims. It can't, obviously, it can't bring back their family members, but it does offer some recognition and some closure. And above all, it also establishes incontestable, undeniable historical legal record in a region where there are many people who still deny the past.
He was also found guilty of involvement specifically in the Srebrenica massacre. Remind us why this event that resulted in the deaths of some 6,000 people. What does this chapter mean, and what was Mladic's role in it?
Well, he was a commander of the force that laid a siege on Srebrenica, which at the time was a UN-protected area.
Right.
And That had been for a couple of years, unfortunately, with the wrong mandate, where the UN forces could not really defend it. They didn't have a mandate to defend this area. Mladic, who was a general commanding the troops, entered the town, ordered separation of men and women, then proceeded to imprison and unfortunately eliminate the remaining menfolk, which included anyone from the age of 9 or 10, the youngest victims, to the ages of 70 plus. And if you go to Srebrenica today and you go to the Srebrenica Memorial, you can see results of those actions, which are a sad indictment of humanity in the 20th and 21st century.
I mean, we're hearing about ethnic cleansing, whether it's actually happening or not in Myanmar right now is kind of beside the point. A lot of people are pointing to it. Do you think leaders will look at this verdict and take pause?
I hope that those who are committing or who are being alleged to have committed crimes in Myanmar, pointing out to military here, or those who have committed crimes in Syria can be reminded of the fact that justice is slow, but it's sure. And I hope that this will either be a reminder or in a way deterrent for those who think that somehow they can act with impunity and that they are somehow above the law.
Of course, Ratko Mladic couldn't have done all of this by himself. How much support is there still among Serbs for men like Mladic today?
Well, that is an interesting question. I mean, I was surprised to hear that the leader, the president of the smaller entity Republika Srpska in Bosnia-Herzegovina, said that the Serbian people are proud of what he did, which is not something nice to say. And, you know, how can a modern 15, 20-year-old living in Europe today be proud of or support anyone who committed crimes like rape and extermination and genocide and, you know, all sorts of war crimes? But my hope is that the future and the world that we live in which we are more open, where there is access to information, that world may provide enough oxygen for young people in Bosnia to see the truth. The proceedings that took place in The Hague, yes, it was slow, yes, it was costly, but I think they will serve as that undeniable historical, factual, legal record of what happened in this region. And that is important, not only when we look back at the past, but above all, it's important for the future, because we've got to, at some point, we have to draw a line and say we're now looking to the future. These scores have been settled. It is time now to hand over this region to the younger generation. And if we hand over that younger generation region in chaos, we have not served them well.
So that's kind of the legal and political future. What about the psychic future? I mean, is the conviction of Mladic a turning point for the people of the former Yugoslavia?
I think it will take a little bit of time. Some horrendous crimes took place. And, you know, you need to have a lot of political leadership, support from the outside, strength to understand and recognize the past if change is going to take place. And I'm an optimist, and I believe that these medieval practices will not be repeated, and that this may serve as a reminder to the citizens of the region that there is a better path. And that path is towards stable and secure, prosperous region that can offer better future to particularly young generation. There is absolutely no other way and no other path.
When you were a refugee, where did Mladic sit in your mind? What was your frame of reference?
It was quite difficult, to be honest, because no one prepares you for war, and no one prepares you for a moment where the military or armed forces that are there to protect you from external and internal threat are going to turn against you. So it took quite some time to believe that actually our neighbors were laying a siege on a neighboring town and allegedly committing crimes. And I was probably quite young to understand all the subtleties and everything that was going on, but I know that he was a man who, for me, represented a man who could stop crimes from happening, but who could also make them even worse. Man who kept Sarajevo under siege for 3.5 years, who kept my family starved and who were killed there during the siege. Everything was in his hands.
Armika Helic was born in the former Yugoslavia. She's now a member of the British House of Lords. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Have a good day.
The verdict is welcomed, of course, by our people, but it does not substitute our losses.
That's Ismail Cidic. He's a 21-year-old student at the University of Sarajevo, and he also moderates an online community called the Bosnian Youth Forum. Cidic was born in 1996. That was after the war between Bosnian Serbs, Bosnian Muslims, and Croats. But he says the ethnic divisions, a legacy of that war, are still very real for people of his generation.
We are actually the members of the first post-war generation, those that are 20, 21, even 22. However, even though we do not have anything to do with the war has a lot to do with us even today. The consequences are everywhere. The whole chemistry in the society is not good, especially because the Serbs, 22 years since the end of the war, glorify Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadžić, the worst war criminals that were sentenced in the Hague Tribunal. They glorify them, they consider them as their heroes, And they completely denied the genocide and atrocities.
Do you remember the first time you heard about Srebrenica in school?
Well, in school, when I was in primary school, nothing was included in curricula. Nothing about the war, about the genocide. All we knew at that time was from the stories of our families. And even today, in huge, in many parts of Bosnia, our students cannot learn anything about the genocide and about the war.
I mean, we heard this summer that Bosnia's Serb leader banned any teaching about the genocide in Srebrenica in schools.
True. Can you imagine? We live in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and in my peers who live in parts where Serbs are majority have to learn the history of Serbia, whole another country. Can you imagine that? That is really ridiculous and complete nonsense.
Do you ever find yourself in debates with other students over the meaning of the war? Like, do you talk about whether the UN was right, this was genocide, or whether, as many Serbs maintain, it was not genocide?
I had the opportunity to discuss with some of my peers, Bosnian Serbs, who are also age 20, 21, 22, and they also consider Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadžić the heroes. So I would say huge majority think in that way, and I cannot imagine when we take positions in the future in politics, in economy, in business, how it would be to deal with the people who consider the war criminals as their heroes. So I would say that we are not even at the beginning of the process of reconciliation.
Ismail, it's kind of amazing to talk with you because, as you said, you were born when the war was over, and yet you talk about it in a way that almost feels
so much.
Still happening.
True.
What do you think that tells us?
I would say that it was partly because of our political system. Just yesterday, we marked the 22nd anniversary since the Dayton Peace Agreement that ended the war was signed.
In Dayton,
Ohio. Yes, Dayton, Ohio. And we are still facing this political system that should have been the temporary solution. 22 years later, we still have the exact same system that can you imagine 13 governments and 3 state presidents, 1 Croat, 1 Bosniak, 1 Serb. And in order to pass any decision, the consensus is needed, which is, you know, very, very rare. And in order for our country to prosper, for me, for myself, for my peers, for the Bosnian youth, in order to develop, we need to change the system to have a stable state.
So what are you going to do about it, Ismail? You're a university student studying political science.
Yes.
What are you going to do after you graduate?
After I graduate, I'm planning to go to master studies abroad, but it is a must for me to come back to Bosnia and to build society inside. As I'm a student of political science, part of it should be and must be enrollment into politics. And of course, to motivate others, my peers, to do the same thing. I hope that those that are very active and that are very good and that are actually studying and living abroad will one day come back in Bosnia so we can start from beginning and we can start changing things.
Ismail Cidic is a student at the International University of Sarajevo. He also helps moderate the online community Bosnian Youth Forum. Thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the show, the jewelry designed to help women avoid harassment and abuse. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman here with The World. Every day, it seems, brings new allegations of sexual harassment by men in positions of power. After the initial shock comes the admission that no one is terribly surprised by any of this, and the U.S. isn't the only country trying to figure out what to do about it. We want to take a look at France specifically right now. Women there are also going public with allegations of abuse. We've got the MeToo hashtag. They've got the Balance Ton Porc hashtag, or squeal on your pig. But there are also big differences between France and the U.S. Anne Penketh is a British journalist who's seen these differences in her many years of working in both France and the U.S. If you sat 10 women from the U.S. and 10 women from France in a room, do you think that they would see their situations as similar?
Well, I think that, you know, the French are still women, and any woman knows the difference between flirtation and harassment, and particularly abuse of power. So from that point of view, no. But on the other hand, there is a sense here in France that Brits and Americans, we are puritanical. In France, even the street and the workplace, they are a place of seduction, really. But that said, this could be a moment here because there's been such an outpouring and the dike has really, really opened.
The New York Times has framed the French outcry against sexual harassment as a revolt. Would you call it that?
I wouldn't go that far, but clearly it is something important. The trouble is with it, as quite a few people have said, that it does conflate all sorts of, you know, anything from a peccadillo, I mean, if it's a hand on knee, to with rape and violent abuse. And also in the case of the Balance Tempore, it's been anonymous. Some of the accusers have said who they are, but the accused are not named in most cases, unless some brave women have actually come out. People, therefore, are saying, well, look, they should take these cases to the court. But then that comes back to the fact that, oh, well, if people are afraid to go to court. I think that now possibly the chance, though, is the president himself, because we've had a change of generation. Emmanuel Macron was talking about this just at the end of last week and encouraging people to come forward and saying that this is a matter for justice and that people should be punished. It remains to be seen what will actually be done from a legislative point of view.
But it comes down, as you say, to recognizing power. So would French and American women have similar ideas about how to move this whole thing forward, how to stop this from happening?
I suspect so, yes. But then it comes down to the men, though, doesn't it? And
that was going to be my next question.
Of course, you can have women. I mean, we're talking abuse of power. It works with women as abusers as well, of course. So in France, because it is a more macho culture than in America, I think even now. And to some extent, men here, they kind of think of lording it over women as their right. Now, things are changing, and I'm hopeful that with, you know, the younger generations, they will simply not put up with it as the older women have.
What do you think needs to happen right now in France to stop sexual harassment? I know it's a huge question, but like if there's one thing you could put your finger on and say, this is a start, what would it be?
Well, I think that the men, instead of denying it, so far, there are at least two or three prominent people I can think of here who have been accused of serious sexual harassment. We've not even had an apology from any of them. Either they're denying or they say, see you in court, or that's it. And so I think that the men really need to wake up here.
British journalist Anne Penketh speaking with us from Paris. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
The men really need to wake up here. Seems like we've heard that a lot on the show in the last few weeks. Sexual harassment, abuse, and assault are obviously pervasive problems. Yasmin Mustafa felt compelled to do something about it. She created Athena. It's a pendant that a woman can wear as a necklace or clipped onto a purse or a piece of clothing. But it also has an emergency button. And Mustafa says that if a woman feels unsafe or is in trouble, she can use the button to quickly alert family, friends, and emergency services. I began by asking her why she developed this device. What was kind of like the trigger moment for you that you came up with this idea?
The trigger moment was about 4 years ago. I had just become a U.S. citizen, and to celebrate, I decided to go backpacking through South America for 6 months. It was incredibly eye-opening because everywhere that I visited, I would hear stories of women attacked or harassed or abused. And I think because I was traveling alone, they were shared sort of as a warning. And a week after I came back to Philadelphia, my neighbor went out to her car and she was dragged from behind and dragged to an alley and beaten and raped. And that was the catalyst, the light bulb moment that inspired the idea. And the idea initially was women use pepper spray and tasers to protect themselves, but you still had to pull them out of your pocket or your purse for them to be useful. And I quickly found out that existing self-defense tools have actually been made by men for other men. When the opportunity to market to women came about, instead of looking for what their specific needs are, they shrunk it and pinked it.
I think, Yasmin, of your friend in Philadelphia or, say, a student walking through campus who's grabbed by someone, maybe an assault is even in process. Is there the time or even the ability to reach this device?
Yeah, it's worn as a clip. It's magnetic so that they can be activated from both hands. Mm. It's still a Band-Aid to the issue of attacks against women, like pepper spray, like tasers, like everything out there where the onus is on women to protect themselves and not wear this, not drink that, and not walk there. And really what we've recognized in talking to psychologists and researchers is that at the base of violence against women is gender discrimination, gender inequality. And that if you educate young children when they're most impressionable about respect and healthy relationships, there was a direct correlation between decreasing harassment, abuse, and attacks against women. So Athena is really kind of a short-term play. To us, it's a better product than existing self-defense tools, but the educational element of it, where for every Athena sold, we invest proceeds into these educational programs, that's the long-term play.
And the price of this device is how much?
Right now, it's $129.
Do you not think that's a kind of an inaccessible price for women? And we know that many poor women are victims of sexual abuse in some ways at a greater rate than affluent women.
Yeah, no, it's true. And right now, it's the lowest price that we can do. But what we're working on right now is a more accessible to more women around the world.
Yasmin Mustafa, thank you very much for your time. Great to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yasmin Mustafa is the creator of Athena, a piece of jewelry she hopes will help women avoid sexual harassment and assault. I'm Marco Werman. A photojournalist with years of experience covering wars starts to question whether his work makes a difference.
I was frustrated with what I was doing as a war correspondent, going on front lines, trying to really be the witness of what was happening on the edge of those conflicts.
So he starts experimenting with virtual reality. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's return to our top story today, a historic moment, Ratko Mladic, the brutal Serbian commander during the war in Bosnia in the 1990s, found guilty of war crimes and genocide by the UN Tribunal in The Hague. It's also a moment to ask about the success of these kinds of tribunals. We heard earlier on the show from Armenka Helic. As a child, she fled the war in the Balkans. Now she serves in the British House of Lords. And Helic thinks that today's verdict shows the relevance of these international institutions, even in a time when some leaders are pulling back from them.
Yes, we are going through some, if I can say, turbulent times. But I do believe that I wouldn't give up on international institutions. I wouldn't give up on the UN, on the ICC. I wouldn't give up on NATO in particular. I wouldn't give up on the EU. These are institutions that have served us well since the end of the Cold War. If we have the confidence in who we are, what we stand for, if our moral spine is strong enough, we will see that the challenges can be temporary.
One journalist who saw the Balkan Wars firsthand is David Rode. He's now the online news director for The New Yorker. And back in 1995, he was one of the first outsiders to see the aftermath of the massacre in the Bosnian town of Srebrenica.
There was evidence of what had happened, but no one was sure of how much. So I was able to get into Serb territory around the town and actually found mass graves full of the bodies of what we now know are 7,000 men and boys who were summarily executed by Ratko Mladic's forces. So it's been, you know, too many years since that time. It was 1995. So, yes, it's delayed. But the fact that he is going to jail for life does create a sense of justice, finally, about what happened in Bosnia.
It has been 25 years since the UN Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia was set up. I mean, Mladic's trial alone has lasted 4 years. It must feel overdue for families of the victims. I mean, what did take so long?
There wasn't much urgency to arrest the commanders of Serb forces. NATO forces, American forces, in 1995 after the war ended. Bill Clinton didn't want American casualties, so Mladic was able to remain free for 14 years. The tribunal itself proved more bureaucratic than affected, and so it created a sense among Bosnian Muslims that bringing Serbs to justice for these crimes wasn't a priority because, again, he was free for 14 years, and as you said, this has taken 25 years.
The Nuremberg trials, probably the most famous tribunals, those are the ones that sentenced Nazis for war crimes after World War II. How far do you think we've come in prosecuting war criminals since then?
A positive step is that virtually every one of the 100 people that this tribunal wanted to bring to justice was brought to justice or passed away. There was a stepped-up effort of arresting people through the 90s and the 2000s. A lot of economic pressure was brought on Serbia that caused Serbia itself to hand over Mladic finally. International law is much stronger. These verdicts have created an enormous historical record of what happened in the war in Bosnia, and they've created a body of law that really defines, you know, what is genocide, what is a crime against humanity, and most importantly, what is command responsibility.
A couple of things occur to me. I mean, first of all, between the last decade and the numbers that kind of measure the success of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, 161 indictments, 83 convictions. What will be the legacy of this tribunal?
I think that it's created a historical record of exactly, you know, how many people died in these situations. You know, the war in Bosnia was one of the first ones where rape was a tool of war. It was systematically used to terrorize. So that's a step forward. This conviction means a great deal to Bosnian Muslims that he was found guilty of genocide. Where it's failed is it has not convinced many Serbs, particularly, you know, the nationals in Bosnia and in Serbia. They just reject this tribunal. A narrative has emerged among Serbs that the tribunal is completely biased, that this is all part of an international conspiracy to vilify Serbs. You see that across countries and in the United States as well, a sort of counter-narratives emerging. A lot of it's online. And so, you know, it has created a sense of justice for Muslim victims. It has not created a sense of guilt among Serbs. It's nowhere near sort of the self-examination you saw among Germans after World War II. There's a rejection among Serbs of these rulings, and that's been one of its failures. I would just have to say it was positive. It's not achieved as much as we'd hoped, but you have these families of these, you know, 7,000 men and boys who I think do have a sense of justice. There were cheers among widows, I think, who were watching the proceedings this morning. So that's valuable.
Right.
The rule of law is slowly spreading, not as quickly, not as effectively as we wanted, but the verdict today is still a major achievement.
Also, David, not to be confused with the International Criminal Tribunal, there's the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which opened in 2002. And a lot of critics say it's not working as intended. Syria comes to mind. Why is the ICC falling short?
A lack of international will. There was strong international will to end the war in Bosnia after these killings around Srebrenica. The War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, you know, has been largely effective. You had a unique situation in Bosnia where there was sort of a weak Russia and the Serbs had no international backer. And that's how the war ended. And the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia was formed. So the broader issue, the permanent body, the International Criminal Court, is weaker and its authority is not spreading.
So 25 years ago when the court was created, I mean, it was a different time. I'm just wondering how you see it and whether there's still kind of the will for cooperation internationally.
I think there's a dramatically different world today where there's various power centers. Russia is much more assertive, China, and there isn't this dominance that existed in terms of the U.S. and Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. So today you would just have total dismissal of, you know, narratives coming out of international bodies. You have the change in technology in the news media where anyone who wants to question a verdict coming out of any court anywhere can usually look online with a few keystrokes and have their sense of victimization justified. And, you know, there's a lot of false information out there. So it's a very different world today. You know, these kind of court proceedings have less authority.
So, David, how hopeful are you that another tribunal could even be established today for, you know, fill-in-the-blank war crime?
I'm not hopeful. I mean, I have to be honest about a sort of strong sense of isolation in the United States. The Trump administration is not a fan of international justice. You have a huge success for Vladimir Putin in Syria, intervening for a dictator in a conflict where 400,000 people have died, and Putin has crushed any effort at justice there. China is not interested in any kind of international tribunals either, so I think we're moving backwards. There's a deep sense, again, of satisfaction that this has finally happened, that Ratko Mladic has been found guilty all these years later, But in terms of other situations and in terms of looking ahead, no, I don't feel optimistic at all about international justice spreading.
You think it's the end of an era for these tribunals?
It is, but these go in cycles. I have great faith in average people. You know, it's wrong to execute 7,000 unarmed men and boys. Everyone knows that. All nationalities know that. So, you know, there was a disastrous American invasion of Iraq. The war in Afghanistan has gone on and on. So I understand the deep sense of isolationism in the United States. But I do think when war crimes are committed, when rape is a tool of war, when genocide is carried out, you know, average Americans feel it's wrong, average people all over the world. And so I think in the long term, there will be more international justice. But right now, it's growing weaker.
David Rode is the online news director for The New Yorker. Thanks very much for being with us, David.
Thank you.
One more note about the Balkan Wars and the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. It's about language. Despite the deep ethnic divisions that fueled the conflicts, the Bosnian, Serbian, and Croatian languages sound a lot alike, like dialects of a single tongue. But you wouldn't have known that from the way language was used and handled at the War Crimes Tribunal. Ellen Elias Bursach worked as a translator at the tribunal for 6 years.
Especially early in the tribunal, many of the defendants were Bosnian Serbs. And a Bosnian Serb, if asked, "What language do you speak?" would say, "Serbian." But the fact of the matter is that the way a Bosnian Serb speaks is the way all the people speak in their town. And the Muslims living in that same town would say they speak Bosnian. So when the people selecting interpreters received requests that the interpreter needed to be working into Serbian, they would find somebody working into Serbian, a professional translator into Serbian from Belgrade, and that's a different way of speaking than the way they speak in Bosnia. Plus, the victims who were testifying, the witnesses, were frightened when they heard Serbian spoken because they associated Serbian language with the atrocities they'd experienced. And so it was a delicate situation. What's interesting with all these differences and so much discussion about differences that goes on between Croatian, Bosnian, and Serbian is that there was very, very little debate in the courtroom and protest about not understanding what was being said.
That was Ellen Elias Bursach, who worked for 6 years as a translator at the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. We'll hear a lot more on the subject of languages and dialects tomorrow on the show, courtesy of our World in Words podcast, so be sure to tune in for that. War and War Crimes, photojournalist Karim Ben Khalifa has seen it all through his camera lens. Khalifa's originally from Tunisia, but now lives in Belgium. He's been all over the world documenting wars and their consequences. But recently, he found himself facing a kind of existential crisis.
I was frustrated with what I was doing as a war correspondent, going on front lines, trying to really be the witness of what was happening on the edge of those conflicts.
Khalifa began to question whether his photographs conveyed the reality he was seeing on the ground, whether his pictures alone could change minds. So he started experimenting with virtual reality.
When I discovered virtual reality, I just wondered, what happened to my journalism? What happened to the audience? Is the level of engagement higher? Mobile phones? How does this impact your memory?
Khalifa is putting those questions to the test through a new exhibition called The Enemy. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou went to check it out at the MIT Museum in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I've never done virtual reality.
Yeah, it's really cool.
To enter this virtual world, I first have to put on some special equipment. A backpack and a virtual reality headset.
Focus.
And just like that, the big empty room around me, the gray walls, it's all transformed.
So I'm walking into a room, all the walls are white, and there are pictures on the walls.
Two black and white photographs hang on opposite sides of the room. As I walk up to them, sound filters through my headset. The first photograph is of an Israeli military tent with soldiers sitting inside. The second is of a young Palestinian throwing rocks at an Israeli military outpost. Then suddenly, the two photographs disappear off the walls. Remember, this is virtual reality. In their place, two portraits, also black and white, fade into existence. Khalifa tells me in a recorded message that one is of a Palestinian fighter, Abu Khalid.
Abu Khalid is a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. He is an athletic, good-looking man.
The other, an Israeli soldier, Gilad. When the narration ends, I hear footsteps. I turn around and see the two combatants walk into the room.
Whoa.
Gilad and Abu Khalid stand in front of their portraits on opposite sides of the room. I watch them from the middle. I can tell they're not real, but they feel so close to it that it's unsettling.
Come to me.
Gilad, the Israeli soldier, calls me over. He's in his khaki uniform, his hands crossed in front of him. When I get close enough, Gilad greets me, and for the next few minutes, I listen to a recording of the photographer asking Gilad a set of questions. What is violence to you? Khalifa asks. Who is your enemy and why? And what is peace for you?
Gilad, where do you see yourself in 20 years from now?
In 20 years from now, I wish to see myself accompanying my little girl to her graduation from the university instead of the ceremony discharging her from the military.
As he speaks, Gilad gestures with his hands. He makes and breaks eye contact, and he keeps me engaged in a way his portrait right behind him didn't. When the conversation ends, I walk to the other side of the room, where the Palestinian fighter Abu Khalid waits for me. He's wearing camouflage, and a mask is covering his face. And he, too, answers a set of questions.
Where do you see yourself in 20 years from now?
I have been through extremely painful situations. 23 members of my family passed away. They died a martyr's death, including my grandfather, my uncles, and children, 8 kids of my family. I have also been severely injured during Israeli occupation, and they've destroyed my home. After all that, I still believe in hoping for a peace that ensures a decent living and a free life inside Palestine.
When the interviews are over, the two men turn to leave. They walk out of the room, alongside each other, never interacting. In the next virtual rooms, I meet 2 more sets of combatants, members of competing gangs in El Salvador, fighters in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Khalifa hopes that meeting these combatants, even in this virtual form, will grab people and help them listen more deeply. But it's not just about the experience. After I go through the exhibition, Khalifa tells me that in reimagining his work, he's grappled with another big question.
Who do I actually want to talk to? Who's my target audience for this work? And the primary target audience is to get to the next generation of fighters. The people who've been told the story about the other, who are in this process of dehumanization because there is no meeting point in between humans in these places for understanding each other and the commonality of each other.
Khalifa's working to bring the exhibition to the Middle East, as well as Africa and Central America, though he did have one showing in Tel Aviv over the summer.
When they get to this Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Israeli or Palestinian audience had to walk towards their enemy, which is not something they do in real life. They would actually do the opposite, but here they're safe enough. That doesn't mean they walk, you know, nicely and comfortably. They go with fear, they go with apprehension, they go with a number of stereotypes, but it's a good way to challenge that.
And while some audiences here in the U.S. may not be Khalifa's primary target, he says there's still much to take away from the exhibition. Will it work? Khalifa admits he doesn't know. It's a proposition, an intervention, he says, one that might leave you with more questions than answers. For The World, Lydia Emanuelidou, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. One more note about our top story today. A court in The Hague has found former Bosnian Serb commander Ratko Mladic guilty of genocide during the Bosnian War of the 1990s. He's been given a life sentence. The verdict may provide some comfort to survivors of his horrific actions, but it won't bring back their loved ones. Still, David Miliband, the former UK Foreign Secretary, says the court has sent a powerful message.
However long it takes, the wheel of justice needs to turn. And certainly for my generation, I was born in 1965. I was in my 20s in Europe in the period when the appalling consequences of the breakup of Yugoslavia led to ethnic cleansing, to genocide. And the fact that the lesson is held that if you commit war crimes, you will be convicted for them, is incredibly important for the future, because it's that drive to truth-telling, to preserve the documentation, to ensure that even those who are lost are not forgotten, is vital, frankly, to civilization going forward. And it's more needed than ever in places like Syria today, in Yemen, where there is punishment of civilians and aid workers on an unprecedented scale, the abuse of international humanitarian law. And the danger is that those who are committing these crimes think they can do so with impunity. The Mladic example shows that there is a chance of ensuring that justice finally sees its day.
We had a longer chat with David Miliband today about some other things. He told us about his new book, Rescue: Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time. He also talked about his family's own history and how just a few months ago he finally learned the fate of his grandfather, who died at the hands of the Nazis. I asked him what went through his mind when he recently found himself standing beside his grandfather's grave outside Stuttgart, Germany, for the first time.
Well, the obvious thing that goes through your mind is that there but for the grace of God go I. How lucky one is to have been able to live, really, because strangers helped my mother. Strangers, a Catholic family in the middle of Warsaw, saved my mother's life. And it was their ability to see humanity and to reach out and save it that allowed our family tree to continue.
Our full interview with David Miliband in the coming days right here on The World. Tomorrow, hundreds of floats and balloons will be streaming down the streets of Manhattan. It's the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And if you've ever wondered about who makes those kinds of giant inflatables, wonder no more. As part of our 50 States project, we sent the world's Jason Margolis to visit a Midwestern company that's transformed itself from a small mom-and-pop operation into a global exporter. Jason's story begins up in Toronto.
I'm at an NBA Toronto Raptors game. It's a blowout. The Raptors are winning big and the fans are getting a little bored. Then the team mascot, the Raptor, appears. The Raptor is a big, round, inflated dinosaur head on human legs. He stands about 6 feet tall. The dinosaur shimmies, does somersaults, then climbs into the crowd and bounces end over end down the stairs to the delight of most everyone. I try to interview the Raptor, but the team tells me dinosaurs can't speak, but he can tweet and type. The Raptor sent me an email after the game and said he gets outfitted from the company Signs and Shapes in Omaha, Nebraska. The Raptor added, quote, "They are amazing and they are always willing to work on my crazy ideas. For example, do yourself a favor and Google Raptor Eats Brooklyn Nets Fan." Signs and Shapes space in Omaha is just about the coolest factory you've ever seen. A huge warehouse filled with dogs, ducks, and astronauts being stitched, then inflated and tested. Scott Bowen is the co-owner.
The company was started in my dad's basement, and my folks' basement, just about 30 years ago, and we started as distributors for inflatable signs.
The company eventually expanded into props for plays, parade floats, and inflatable costumes. Today, Signs and Shapes exports to 74 countries. Bowen flips through a photo book showing me some of their overseas customers.
Chinese basketball team, a dentist's office in Spain.
Picture a friendly but weird-looking orange creature with braces. Then there's my favorite customer, a Swiss pizzeria.
There's an inflatable pizza slice running around some town in Switzerland, I guess. That's
cool. It's a fun company. But what lessons can another small business learn about becoming a global exporter? Lee Bowen, Scott's father, who helps run international sales, tells me how they find their foreign customers.
Word of mouth.
It's just that simple.
Yes. We don't do any advertising.
Signs and Shapes relies on reputation and having a niche. If you want a high-end inflatable that won't pop when your mascot is bouncing on its head in front of 20,000 people, call Omaha. Business is going well, but they're at 25 employees, and Scott Bowen says they're limited how much they can grow.
We need seamstresses with a really high level of sewing intelligence that can look at a pattern of a couple hundred pieces that's never been made before and put the whole thing together accurately, but that also have, you know, sort of a business or commercial mentality in terms of speed.
Everybody in the industry complains that in this country it's hard to find people who have those construction skills.
Michael James chairs the Textiles, Merchandising, and Fashion Design Department at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says textiles manufacturers, and that's what Signs and Shapes really is, could never compete with China and its seemingly endless supply of seamstresses who are paid a fraction of what people in the U.S. make.
A small manufacturer like Signs and Shapes can keep everything in-house because they're not doing huge volume. If they ever got to that point where the demand was so big, they wouldn't be able to find the production capacity here in this country at a cost that they could probably manage.
And then there's another issue. Again, letting the product speak for itself has become Signs and Shapes' best marketing strategy. But the company can't publicly take credit for some of the coolest stuff they make due to non-disclosure agreements. It can be highly secretive. In a back room, airbrush artist Shane Perrin puts the finishing touches on a mascot as Scott Bowen looks on.
He's had stuff on Broadway stages, the biggest amusement parks, huge international sporting events. So we've done something which, again, we can't include, but we did something for the last year.
So did you see your creation at the what was that gratifying?
Oh, definitely. It's always gratifying to see stuff, you know.
But you couldn't tell anybody, hey, I made that.
No, but I can tell them, hey, that's really neat, isn't it? And then wink a lot, you know, but that's about it.
So if you're watching a parade tomorrow and see a float roll by that you really, really like, chances are a group of folks in Nebraska may have had a hand putting that together. Or not. For The World, Jason Margolis, Omaha, Nebraska.
In a story, Jason mentioned that most of our clothes aren't sewn here in the U.S. anymore. We'll be talking about that in a big way on the show. Our Across Women's Lives team is in Bangladesh right now reporting on who makes our clothes. The story is coming up soon on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. If you've got a long weekend coming up, enjoy it. Those of you who don't will still be here. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.